Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, June 1st. And this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And also in the studio from the Falmouth Enterprise, we have Brittany Feldon. Good morning, Brittany.
Morning, Steve.
And joining us later, we'll hear from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis from SouthCoastToday.com. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands and the South Coast. The state announced this week an array of grants to local towns to start planning for the effects of climate change and coastal vulnerability. The feeling behind this seems to have really stepped up after last winter's storm, Cindy.
Yeah, well, Massachusetts Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Matthew Beaton took in the view at Nauset Beach on Tuesday, and he remarked on what Cape Coders know all too well. He said the Cape Islands have the most beautiful but also the most vulnerable of natural resources in the world. He did say in the world, which I wasn't aware of, but we know that we're on the sand spit out here. And this was, a group of Cape legislators and town officials who were out there talking about the region getting $284,000 to repair, to address this climate change and this significant erosion, then we were just whacked by these storms this winter. And this is out of $2.16 million to 82 Massachusetts towns.
Now, these grants are for plans for towns to start making plans to address climate change.
Yeah, they're not actually to bring in the sand. They're actually to help assess the problem areas, develop adaptations, and look at these prioritized wish lists for different towns.
Mm. And what kinds of things have we heard that might be on the docket here? Nauset, I know, lost a lot of beach last in the storms of the last winter.
Well, Nauset lost 60 feet of a beach there in Orleans, and that was significant. And of course, and it took down, resulted in that very popular snack bar, Liam's, having to be, dismantled and replaced. Well, not replaced yet, but totally dismantled, which was a sort of a landmark restaurant there on the beach. And so, what they're looking at is, and Orleans is really facing a lot of erosion. They thought it's gone from 3 to 12 feet a year, so that's pretty significant. And they quickly assembled a dune after the winter storms, but they do plan to build a larger protective dune on Nauset Beach. That's one of the plans. And they also are looking at areas that are, they plan to use their $25,000 grant to identify areas at risk, because it's not just the beach. It's just that they have these low-lying parts of town or different parts of town that get flooded during storms. And portions of town were cut off this winter, and people were stranded in different parts of town. And the George Meservey, the town director of planning and community development, said that there are a lot of older people living in these areas that are kind of all scattered about. And this is a vulnerable population. They have to be protected, and they have to figure out a way to get them out in a storm and address some of these areas.
This is a big issue we're going to be talking about a lot going forward.
Yeah,
I know that.
More and more.
I want to talk about a story out this week. Sergeant Sean Gannon of the Yarmouth Police was killed in April while serving a warrant. Since that time, the town has been honoring his memory in some very visible ways. And now it may be time for some of those to come down, but the town and some legislators making it clear that the efforts to honor Gannon will continue.
Well, one of the most visible signs of support were all the blue ribbons that we saw along the roads in Yarmouth, but also extending into Barnstable and other towns that was to honor his memory. But now Yarmouth Police Chief Frank Fredrickson went on Facebook, and he was asking residents to take them down before they fade and start to actually look kind of tattered, which would be, considered a sign of disrespect to Officer Gannon, who was posthumously promoted to sergeant. And so he asked residents to take them down in public areas where they're on telephone poles and street signs, and bring them to police department, and they will dispose of them. But he cautioned against going onto people's private property to remove the ribbons, of course. And he said that another thing he said, that people want to continue, having blue lights to honor Gannon and the police, that would be okay. That, continue with that. But he's definitely looking at further action, legislative action even.
Systemic kind of action here. And what are some of the things that they are looking at to honor Gannon and to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again if they can?
Well, Fredrickson and the Massachusetts Chief of Police Association is actually pushing for tougher judicial approaches. They want a different approach to violent criminals, not only on the part of the judges, but on the part of parole officers and probation officers. Massachusetts Senator Vinny DiMacedo, a Republican from Plymouth, has filed a legislative amendment that would require a 10-year minimum sentence for anyone convicted of attempted murder of a police officer by shooting a firearm. And it's passed the Senate, and it's now in conference committee.
And then they're also looking at trying to provide more training.
Yes, this is a proposal, a budget amendment filed by Senator Julian Sear, a Democrat from Truro. This would add $2 to every car rental transaction, and this would go for all kinds of expanded training for police officers, for sexual assault investigators and school resource officer training and instructor courses. And the idea is a better trained police force is also a better protected police force.
Brittany Feldot of the Falmouth Enterprise is in the studio with us. Brittany, you've reported a two-part series on mental health care for children and adolescents on Cape Cod. Second part is out today. One of the things that you examine is the importance of early intervention. Tell us about this.
Sure. So, yeah, last week we explored a little bit about the challenges that youth face on Cape Cod in getting access to mental health care resources. And this week we look at some of the solutions that providers are trying to create to alleviate that deficit and improve services for youth. And one thing that, really across the board, both parents and families that we were able to interview as well as providers stressed is early intervention for mental illness. One mental health clinician, Tracy Moulton, stressed that like any illness, early intervention is beneficial to alleviate some of those symptoms from worsening, and in some cases really preventing some of those secondary consequences like school dropout and, in the worst cases, suicide and some of those severe losses. So this is true for mental illness. And then practically speaking, for parents, early intervention is actually quite urgent because for parents, once a child or a teenager turns 18, they really have much less authority in their life to request services and try and get them the services they need. After a child turns 18, they're really on their own to request medication, therapy, counseling, and do that on their own. So early intervention is really, really key for mental illness.
And then another thing you're looking at in this article is about integrated care. Tell us what that is.
Sure. So integrated care is something that some pediatric offices across the Cape are trying to do. So one of those things they're trying to do to alleviate the issue and access for mental health care for youth. Integrated care, a few pediatric offices are trying to offer therapy in-house so that children, especially young children, toddlers, teenagers who need mental health services such as counseling can actually get that in their pediatric office. This offers a couple things. First, it takes the load off of therapists and counselors who on CAPE are definitely overloaded and there's an issue getting access to those. So it makes it easier for families to access. And then it also decreases the stigma for children, for teenagers who might not be comfortable seeking out those services at a different location. But if they can get some of that in their pediatric office, they may be more likely to pursue that ultimately.
And one of the takeaways from this article is the effectiveness of treatment. I thought that was one of the takeaways and important message to have out there.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think last week when we focused on some of the challenges, it's a little bit tough, can be a little bit depressing. But I think it should be hopeful for families that depending on the illness that children struggle with, depression, anxiety are some of the most common. Treatment, both therapy and medical treatment, medication treatment, can be very effective.
You can see both parts of this series at the website for the Falmouth Enterprise. That's capenews.net. Brittany Feldot from the Falmouth Enterprise, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
We're going to speak now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, you have a fun story about Cape and Islands young man. He's got a family vineyard connection who's competing on this season of The Bachelorette. That's a popular TV show, if you're wondering. And you got to go to this family's viewing party for this.
I did, yes. I got to go to the viewing party for the first episode of The Bachelorette, the new season, which premiered on Monday. And as you said, there's a local contestant who has Cape and Island ties, and that's Ryan Peterson. He's a 26-year-old. His family lives in Mashpee, and he and his family are well-known on the Cape and Islands. His brother, Kurt Peterson, lives on the vineyard and runs catboat charters out of Edgartown, which is really well known for having the sailboat with the American flag sail. And the whole family is known for being musical, for playing music and performing around the Cape and being seafaring. And Ryan Peterson actually had his Bachelorette debut a few months ago, so he's kind of unveiled as one of the Bachelors when there was a little preview of the season, and the Bachelorette, whose name is Becca, met five of the men who would be competing to win her affection this season. and one of them was Ryan. He came out playing the banjo, and he serenaded the bachelorette, and she seemed really charmed, and it seems that that was pretty memorable to a lot of viewers, too. There were stories online with headlines like, who is the banjo player from the bachelorette who, you know, stole her heart? And it turns out the banjo was actually also part of what got him on the show in the first place. He recently moved to Southern California, and he said he was playing the banjo on Manhattan Beach in Southern California. He was also happened to be sitting on a mattress. He said he brought his mattress out with him when he drove across the country, and he dislikes sand. So I think that got attention, a guy playing a banjo on a mattress on the beach. And a producer from the show approached him and asked if he was interested in coming and being on The Bachelorette. He went in for an audition with his banjo in tow, and he won a spot and went on and to be in the competition. And so as you said, this week his family had a viewing party for him at their house in Mashpee. Friends and family and neighbors were there, and everyone, you know, was really excited for him, really excited to see him on the show finally. There were big cutouts of his face decorating the house, which he said was kind of embarrassing, but he said it was, you know, it was really a fun time. And he didn't get too much screen time on the show this week, maybe because he was introduced earlier. But at the end of the episode, he did get a rose from Becca, the bachelorette, so he is moving on in the competition, and he'll be seen next week on the show. And, of course, he can't say how far he goes in the competition. He can say he had a great time and met lots of great people, and he'll be spending the summer on the Cape and Island, so he might be you might see him around on the catboat or playing his banjo here.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick, Big Brother program on the Cape has announced that it's expanding its police mentorship program into Mashpee now.
Yeah, this program is called the Bigs and Blue program, and it's a new partnership with the Mashpee Police Department and the Boys and Girls Club of Cape Cod. So it's a one-to-one mentoring program between officers and youth, and they'll meet at the Boys and Girls Club once a week, and this will be time on the clock for the police officer, and it'll give them time to get to know these kids and provide some leadership, some positive leadership and positive role models.
So what ages are they typically working with?
Well, they're looking at, typically their child participants are between ages 7 to 12, and they usually come from a single-family household and qualify for free and reduced school meals. And there are, this program also exists in Barnstable and Yarmouth, but now it's expanding into Mashpee. And according to officials from Big Brothers Big Sisters, Mashpee has been a particularly hard town to get mentorships in, and they said that on the Cape there are 100 children on a waiting list waiting for mentors. So this will definitely make a dent in it.
And what kinds of things are they doing there with the program?
Well, they'll be meeting for 1 hour a week at the Boys and Girls Club, but the Boys and Girls Club offers a ton of activities. They have after-school sports, there's homework support, there's character and leadership programs. They just do a lot for the community, and they also have summer programs, and they're both starting up their summer programs. So they have a full roster of activities there. So, you know, they can do sports, they can discuss homework, you know, go over homework. It'll be really in a large part up to the big and the little.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker with us from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy McCormick, we're going to the break now. Brittany Feldot from the Falmouth Enterprise, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
And when we come back, we're going to speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, Chatham has its first ever full-time school resource officer. You've got a nice profile of him and the story of what this means for the town.
Sure. This came about in a kind of an interesting way. Shortly after the Parkland, Florida shootings, Chatham Chief of Police Mark Paulina went before the Chatham Board of Selectmen to talk about his annual budget, as he does every year. And he used the opportunity to talk a little bit about school security. And one of his recommendations was a full-time school resource officer. He wasn't really asking for any funds for that at the time, but the Board of Selectmen seized on this, and they added it to the budget, much to his surprise. And At that point, Chatham's school resource officer only worked part-time at the two schools here in town, the Monomoy Middle School and Chatham Elementary School. Town meeting approved that funding last month, and a couple weeks ago, Paulina appointed Sergeant William Massey as the school and the town's first full-time school resource officer. And now Sergeant Massey was previously the sort of part-time school resource officer, where he was in the schools on occasion. He couldn't spend the whole time there because he also has the shift supervisor job. And but the chief says now this is sort of having a full-time resource officer is a real priority. Sergeant Massey will be working directly with school officials, teachers, and students. One of the things they'll be doing is trying to identify and keep an eye on kids who may be at risk, and really kind of getting the kids, especially the younger kids, comfortable with a police officer and what they do. He already interacts with the school resource officer in Harwich, and throughout the Cape, other towns have school resources officers, and they get together regularly and share information about trends and things that they may be seeing in the schools. But Sergeant Massey tells us just being in the schools and being face to face with the kids is really the big deal here, and he hopes that will counteract negative stereotypes he says the kids see in social media and on the internet. Now, Sergeant Massey has been with the department since 2005. He previously worked as a DARE officer in another school, and Steve, mm-hmm. you may remember the DARE program mm-hmm. a few years ago. Some people question whether that was successful, but Sergeant Massey says the way that school resource officers work now, being in the schools, interacting with the kids, is really the way to go. And he has two kids in the Chatham Elementary School, so he's really kind of plugged into things. So there's a lot of hope that that this is going to be a good move and really help not only security, but just making the school environment more of a better place for the kids.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Cindy McCormick is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, some Massachusetts legislators are sponsoring a bill whose intention appears to be supporting the effort to solve the Cape's problems with its aging bridges. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's called the ESCAPE Act, and that's short for a very long act. It's the Enhancing the Strength and Capacity of America's Primary Evacuation Routes. And as we know here on the Cape, that the Sagamore and Bourne Bridges are it for automobiles.
If we're trying to get
anywhere off Cape, those are the bridges. And this act, if it passes, would dedicate $1 billion a year to strengthen and the infrastructure, increase capacity of the nation's evacuation routes. And, of course, the bridges are de facto evacuation routes.
And who's sponsoring this?
Well, this is being sponsored by U.S. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Edward Markey from Massachusetts, of course, and Congressman William Keating, as well as John Garamendi, who's a congressman from California. And part of the act, the proposed act does seem to be aimed toward the Cape, because it specifically addresses the Cape and how our bridges are a lifeline for Cape Codders. And this was announced one day yesterday before the start of the hurricane season, which I guess means today is the start of the hurricane season.
Which means you start thinking about evacuation in the event of a major storm like that, and what the bottleneck is for us here as we're trying to get across two narrow bridges. We're hoping that's not going to have to happen in an evacuation. This is the bill that's proposed here. It really does seem to be catered towards thinking about what a longer-term solution is going to be here.
Yeah, and people are really talking a lot about replacement, just replace those two bridges. They were built in the 1930s, and they were designed to handle cars of that era, which were smaller than their contemporary cars. And the lanes of the bridge are 10 feet wide. That's 2 feet narrower than current standards. So both the Army Corps of Engineers and the Massachusetts Department of Transportation have been looking into these studies about what to do about the bridges, and final reports could be released later this year.
Is there any sense about where those final reports might be leaning?
Officials are leaning toward replacement. That's according to Army Corps Canal Manager Sean McDonald. He said that in March. So they're definitely leaning toward replacement. And then there's some discussion of, like, how you would replace this. I mean, would there be one-way bridges and a toll? And who would pay for this? Would this be a private-public partnership and the toll would help pay for it? Or Randy Hunt, the rep from Sandwich, has suggested that the federal government pay to replace the bridges and then the state take over management of them.
Well, again, this is a long-term fix that they're looking at, and you imagine that it's going to take a little while to put this all together.
Yeah. In 2013, a new bridge and connector road was estimated to cost $320 million and take 10 years to build. So this is something that's not going to happen overnight. This traffic solution isn't, you know, imminent, but something has to be done.
A proposal for a new hotel to be built in Falmouth is meeting some obstacles, including, I guess, its potential impact on the sewer system.
Yes, well, I hope that our listeners have already had their breakfast because they are talking a lot of sewage here. They said that the Falmouth Wastewater Superintendent Amy Lowell said that with all the current and future projects on the table, this would help boost the town's discharge to 585,000 gallons a day, which is more than 80% of a state set limit, which is 710,000 gallons a day. And what would happen is this would trigger a state requirement to submit plans for future expansion, which would be quite costly.
Well, tell us about the proposal itself. What are they looking at here?
Okay, it would be a 78-room hotel and a 100-seat restaurant at the corner of Main and Scranton Avenue in Falmouth. And the developers say it would provide jobs and about $200,000 in annual real estate and room taxes per year. And this is on the site of a vacant bank building. This was vacated by Cape Cod 5. And so they're saying, you know, this will be a boon to the economy. And it'll be, you know, it'll be a nice-looking structure. It'll bring tourists to the town. Another issue is that, for one thing, though, it is it is within the sewage, the hookup area. But the Board of Selectmen must approve a variance that would allow it to hook up to the sewer system, which is why they're in front of the Board of Selectmen discussing this issue. And one of the selectmen was like, well, why don't you just use the existing – you can use the existing septic system. But Robert Ament, an attorney representing the developer, said that this just wouldn't be a good solution.
There's a couple of other concerns around this. I guess some of the selectmen asking if what the impact this might have on affordable housing.
Yeah, that was a concern of Selectman Samuel Patterson. He said that you'll be creating the jobs with salaries. That's a good thing. But they probably won't all be covering the cost of living in Falmouth and getting housing in Falmouth. So he said, we really want to develop that area of Main Street. But how about throwing some affordable housing into the mix? And now Robert Ubbin said that the Cape Cod Commission would require a substantial contribution to affordable housing during the review process of this development, which is by the Westport-based La France Hospitality Corporation. But he said it wouldn't necessarily be providing it on site. They'd have to make some contribution to affordable housing, but it wouldn't necessarily be on site. He says Ahmed was saying it's probably not appropriate to have affordable housing on top of a hotel.
Staying with Falmouth, in the last year, we heard a lot about proposals for new beach rules in town. Now it looks like those rules may be getting closer to being decided.
Yes, the selectmen expect to vote on June 4th, and they promise that they've got a whole bunch of new rules and regulations that are proposed. They promise that won't spoil the summer fun at the town's 10 beaches, but there are some new rules, in consideration. And then, for one thing, would delineate the hours that beaches would be staffed with lifeguards, and ban pets from beaches and parking lots from May to October, prohibit alcoholic beverages, fires, and barbecue grills on the beach areas, as well as bar smoking and vaping. Jason Chorches, who's chair of the beach committee, said that he realizes this won't make everybody happy, but they really took a long look at policies from other towns and also considered emails that were sent in by residents with all their suggestions.
And I guess a few other things that they're looking at there, some activities, whether they can be played and what the rules are around those.
Well, they said they will allow ball playing, kite flying, and beach games, but it'll be up to lifeguard discretion, which, think about it, it makes sense. I mean, if you've got a really crowded beach and you might have to, put that frisbee away or something if it's hitting people in the head. But if it's, there's a lot of room for everybody on the beach, go ahead and play, have fun. They will also limit the maximum size of beach umbrellas and canopies to 10 by 10 feet. I guess those are just getting larger and larger. And they want lifeguards to be able to have a view of the water and the people in it. And would also ban watercraft, fishing, and scuba diving during in the swimming areas when the beach is open.
We're going to speak now with Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, more cruise ships are coming to Provincetown this summer. Explain for us, those of us who don't see cruise ships on our end of the Cape, what this is about.
Well, this is a fairly recent development in the last couple of years. Last year, there were 10 or 12 stops by, these are not the giant cruise ships, but somewhat smaller ones, although they still look pretty big. This year, the harbor master, Rex McKenzie, says that the number of visits by cruise ships is going to be up to 19. The first one, the 267-foot American Constitution, which is run by the American Cruise Lines, stopped in town on Monday night this week and arriving about 11 p.m., spent the day here on Tuesday and then took off about midnight on Tuesday. There are two other ships that are also scheduled to make stops this summer and fall. One is the Windstar, which is 440 feet, and another one, Victory 2, 296 feet. If you want to see what it looks like, you can go to the Provincetown Banner's website at wickedlocal.com and see a photo that our photographer, Vince Guadagno, took from the Pilgrim Monument. And it's a big ship. So the Provincetown Public Pier Corp and the local business organizations, the Chamber of Commerce and Provincetown Business Guild, have been pushing this idea for a number of years to bring more people to town. These ships typically carry about 150 to 200 passengers plus crew, and each visit, there's a fee to the town of $1,000 per visit plus $2.50 per passenger. So it does bring some revenue into the pier corporation, as well as a certain amount of business. Although there's some controversy about what the real economic benefits versus downside of cruise ship activity is. Some people point out that these cruises typically offer all-inclusive services. Mm-hmm. So, for example, all meals are on the ships. Some of the ships even will give you a box lunch to take on shore. Mm. So these are not typically tourists who come and spend a lot of money in restaurants. They're mostly looking for trinkets or taking tours on the trolley or out into the dunes. I think in some cases maybe there's time for a whale watch. Other people also point out that they don't necessarily like the way these giant ships look in little Provincetown Harbor. The business people in general seem to be in favor of it, and the number of trips is definitely increasing. The ship that was here this week, the American Constitution, is planning to make, I believe, 10 or 11 more visits all throughout the summer and into the early fall.
So, again, they're looking at maybe 19 trips expected this summer?
19 is the number that Rex McKenzie, the harbor master, pier manager, told us. And typically they just stay for one day. He told us that their original plan was to get in late at night and then leave the next late afternoon around 5:30 or so. But he said that that created some problems for them because they would sometimes be getting into the next port at midnight, and say in Boston, if they're heading from Provincetown to Boston, he said the condo owners were complaining about noise and commotion of the ships arriving that late, and so they called and asked if they could stay later. And McKenzie said, "You want to leave your passengers in my town for an extra 6 hours? Sure. Okay." So that seems to be the typical schedule for this summer. We'll see what happens as this business continues to grow.
Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve.
Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, the town of Truro received from the state some land a few years back on which it intends to build affordable housing. Your reporter Marianne Bragg has an update on that effort.
Yeah, the select board is preparing a bid package on this, and this is a plot of land in Truro. Yeah, it was originally intended to be part of a Route 6 Cloverleaf off-ramp, which was never built. And now it's becoming that much closer to being much-needed rental apartments. And this this project is actually being known as the Cloverleaf Housing Project, and it would provide 30 to 40 rental units right near the village center in North Truro. It's bordered by the Cape Cod National Seashore, and there's a bus stop right by there, so it makes it convenient for people who are working. And that's the goal, is to get these young working families to stay in Truro, where the cost of housing is so pricey.
And tell us what the affordable housing might look like. They're figuring out right now in terms of apartments and what sizes.
Well, they're looking for 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms. And right now the talk is about making 50% available to those making just 80% of the area median income. Truro is the Cape's smallest and most rural town. But again, it has this really pricey real estate. And right now their town is preparing requests for proposals. And they think a recommendation for a developer could be in front of the select board in about 4 months, and that's according to housing consultant Lidara Zola. This is a partnership with the state. The state gave the town this 4 acres of land that belonged to the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. And it looks like that the town will be also in line for a lot more money, possibly in the future, through a granting process. And they could get they've already received $7,500 from the Massachusetts Housing Partnership to hire an engineering firm for the site. And now, since the town has been named a Massachusetts Housing Choice Community in May, it puts it in line for even more state funds and grants.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, with us from the Cape Cod Times, Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Oh, we're going to go to George in another few moments. Cindy McCormick, an innovative substance abuse program in Mashpee is marking an anniversary. Indications are that it's made a positive impact and it will be continuing. Tell us about this.
Well, this is a program that was the brainchild of Mashpee Town Manager Rodney Collins, and it's a drop-in night, and it occurs once a month. And this is run by the Mashpee Substance Abuse Task Force. Basically, what it does, it's sort of like a resource fair where there are tables and booths with materials from different like recovery centers, health programs, law offices, and people are welcomed at the door and they come in, they're guided through. It's meant to be a very kind of like gentle and confidential process, so that because people feel there's still a lot of stigma around addiction, and what they want to do is break the stigma and let people know there's help out there.
So this drop-in night has been going on for a year now. It happens once monthly. What kind of organizations are there and what's happening there?
Well, it is the law offices, recovery centers, you know, addiction counselors, people from health programs who can help you link up to services, and that there's people who staff it. There's also volunteers who participate in this program. It's estimated that 15 to 25 people show up per meeting. They include parents and grandparents of addicts who are seeking help for their loved ones and family and friends, as well as the addicts themselves. But they're not sure like how many actual addicts are showing up, because like this is a confidential process. This is to help them get their feet wet, look at the programs that are out there, let them know that there is help available.
And going forward, it looks like the town is supportive of this in a big way. They really want to see this continue.
They're going to continue this, at least they say, into 2019. And the Tuesday anniversary, that will take place from 4 to 7 at the Mashpee Public Library. It will feature a talk by Gosnold Certified Recovery Coach Kevin Rosario. And town officials say that they really want to, if they even save one person, that this has been worth it. And they also have trained about, this program has trained about over 50 people in the use of Narcan.
There's some moving testimony here in the article from folks who go there, or the treatment folks, saying that it really has the potential to make a big difference for people.
Right, and just having that sense of community, and that there's someone has your back, someone's out there wanting to help you, come on in, you know, and see what's available. They feel can really help people and reduce stigma.
We're going to speak now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, a fast ferry to Rhode Island lost power this week. It turns out it was some loose equipment, they think, that caused this. You had a reporter on the tugboat that pulled this ferry to shore. What can you tell us about this?
That's right. Yeah, that was reporter Rich Salzberg, and he heard about this early on, went down to Packer, which is a company here in Vineyard Haven, jumped on one of the tugs and ended up being out there during this ordeal. And we're finding out now that it had to do with an accidental activation of some emergency stop switches in the wheelhouse of the ferry. That kind of raises some new questions, because those stop switches are right in the wheelhouse, and apparently something fell on them, triggering them, and it's unclear why the crew didn't know about that. So, you know, we're continuing to follow this story and try and figure out exactly what went wrong that day. But all's well that ends well. More than 70 passengers on board were brought in safely. First towed by CETO out of Falmouth, and then they were met up by the tugboat that Rich was on, and they were brought into Vineyard Haven, where they picked up a steamship. The passengers were let off, and they were brought over on a Steamship Authority ferry.
And this, so, there was a fair amount of weather that day, it sounds like.
That's right. You know, the Steamship Authority, this time of year, they run some of their ferries into Oak Bluff. And when weather conditions are like they were on Sunday, they often divert. And they did that on Sunday, meaning their ferries went from Woods Hole to Vineyard Haven instead. And also, the Island Queen, which is out of Falmouth, stopped some of its runs during the day because of the weather conditions. And the Highline, which goes from Hyannis to the Vineyard, stopped some of its runs as well because of the weather conditions. It was very windy and quite a bit of surf out there. So, the Ava Pearl, you know, did head out and had this lost power, and everybody got back to shore safely.
George, you've also
a good job.
You've got a story about an assisted living facility in Edgartown that's slated to close. From the profile, it sounds like a special and very unusual place.
Yeah, this was a really nice story. This was done by Bella Bennett, and you know, she had a personal connection to this in that one of her grandparents was there and just passed away recently. So she knows very well what Long Hill is all about. And Elizabeth Sandland is the woman who started Long Hill in Edgartown and sort of saw a need on the island for a place where families could have their elderly relatives cared for without going into a nursing home. And unfortunately, Elizabeth herself is not doing too well these days health-wise, and so she's made a decision that after 26 years, she's going to be closing down Long Hill. Very sad for a lot of people and a lot of families who have been cared for at Long Hill through the years. This weekend, on Sunday, June 3rd, they're having a little gathering there from 1 to 4 p.m., for people to share stories and memories of Long Hill. And it's funny, Nancy asked that you bring a dish to share with the community if you're hoping to go to this event. But, yeah, it's a very touching story, and I really encourage people to take a look at it, see the personal connection as well as some of the other stories that people are telling about Long Hill.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Memorial Day came this past Monday. You have a nice profile of Barnstable's parade and activities to remember those who served.
Yeah, this was the parade in Centerville. It's very moving, lovely occasion. It starts on Main Street in front of the library. Then the parade heads over to Monument Square, where there's some speeches and prayers and the laying of wreaths, and then makes its way to Beechwood Cemetery. There are Boy Scouts, two different bagpipe bands, the Barnstable High School Marching Band, the Yarmouth Minutemen doing musket salutes. But it was interesting because it wasn't like, we know this Memorial Day was not a beautiful sunny day. Mm. It was overcast, but at the same time, these flowers are blooming, bursting out all over. And it was an interesting combination of the somber and this life of spring, but this just spring bursting forth, because the keynote speaker, Ralph Negron, who is a retired Marine Corps lieutenant colonel and a history professor at Cape Cod Community College, gave a very moving talk about being a young Marine and realizing his own mortality when he was on the tarmac in Okinawa waiting for his plane to take off for Da Nang in Vietnam. And he saw a forklift lift coffins into an Air Force plane. And he said that he and his fellow Marines just, you know, fell into silence at seeing that. He said, keep in mind that many of those killed in combat were right out of high school. They are the real heroes of any war. He said, this is their special day.
You go on to really describe some of the events that were there that were happening to commemorate Memorial Day here and some of the people who spoke. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, another speaker was the Reverend Bruce Epperly. He's pastor of the South Congregational Church in Centerville. And he asked the scores of attendees and parade goers to also remember the grieving families and those suffering from the invisible wounds of war. And this was something taken up by Duke Ellis of Veterans for Peace, who held up a photograph of a young man who died from suicide after serving in Iraq. And he said that this was at the Beechwood Cemetery, which was the endpoint for the parade, and people were asked to hold up pictures of veterans they had known and loved. And Duke Ellis said that the group is planning a memorial for those suffering what are said to be in the invisible wounds of war, which includes PTSD, traumatic brain injury, any sexual assault that had been suffered. And he said they'll probably start out with a mobile memorial, and then they hope to have something more permanent in the future. It's all in the planning stage right now.
Andy Tomolonis joins us right now from SouthCoastToday.com and the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, you have an election recount story for us, and one that gets complicated and raises a number of questions about the process. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this was a crazy recount, and it was from the election in April, so it's quite a ways away from the original election. So this election in Fairhaven, the town of Fairhaven, wasn't a really big election. There was a low turnout, 5 or 6%, mostly uncontested races. But there was one race with these three candidates who were vying for two positions on this non-paying Board of Public Works. So one of the candidates was the top vote getter, and he won, easily. The other two candidates for the remaining seat were tied with 338 votes, so that needed to be, grounds for a recount. But then there was some confusion with the town's bylaws. One of the candidates missed the deadline. Selectmen were all set to appoint somebody to fill that post. But there was a little confusion about whether selectmen could make that appointment or a different board, the Board of Public Works. So it went to a judge who solved the problem, telling Fairhaven to go on with the recount. And so that was set for Tuesday night, this past Tuesday. And this is where things got a little crazy. It was sort of a Murphy's Law night. After registrars hand-counted all the ballots, I think there were about 800 of them, and they did it in blocks of 50, the town clerk announced the winner, and it was the candidate, Hoppy Hobson, who's a popular character in town. And he won 308-300. But something wasn't right, because all the candidates had somehow lost votes during the recount process, which didn't make sense, including the overall winner. So after about an hour of trying to figure things out, the recount effort ended. An official winner wasn't called. The winner was announced, but it wasn't put down into writing and forwarded. So most of the participants there, they left Tuesday night thinking there'd be some kind of another recount that would have to be scheduled. But on Wednesday morning, the mystery was solved, and it's a crazy one. Apparently, they had just forgot to count all the write-in votes. So these were kept in separate envelopes, and they did not get included in the ballot. So it was a little bit of a Keystone Cops thing. So they had set up another recount, and one of the candidates threatened to sue the town and ask for a new election, which of course would cost money, of course. And so, you know, another candidate decided to back out. So sparing everything, you know, one candidate left, and it's over now. The person who was originally declared the winner is the winner, and things are set. And it's odd because there was a similar crazy episode about 5 years ago involving a Board of Health race. So, yeah, in the town, there's also there was a move this year to make the town clerk's appointment an appointed position instead of an elected one.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had an ad hoc committee that was assembled, and they went to look at all the different options. And the committee recommended, I think it was like 5-3, to go ahead. And they brought it to town meeting, and town meeting went the other way. So it's still an elected position. And so there are fears, or maybe some anxiety, this kind of thing might happen again if there's somebody who doesn't, stay responsible for everything that happens in the clerk's office.
The town clerk being the one who oversees that election and the recount process.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of different jobs. I mean, the town clerk has a lot of responsibilities, and one of them is election. And there were some crazy elections in town, very contested, and even though there was low turnout, there's just odd events that twists and turns that made this more complicated.
Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com and New Bedford Standard Times, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Cindy McCormick, I want to return to Memorial Day quickly because also in Memorial Day, Cape Cod Times had an article about a cemetery in Dennis that holds 42 veterans, all from the same family. This is quite a story.
And this is the House Family Agent Cemetery. It's off Bramble Lane. Excuse me. And it dates back to the early 1700s and includes the gravesites of Mary and Thomas House. They left England in 1637 to settle in Salem. But within 2 years, they moved over to 100 acres on what is now known as Dennis. And the cemetery was originally part of the original farm property. And these 42 veterans, served from King Philip's War to the Korean War.
And right now, the cemetery is not in great condition, it sounds like, or needs to have some attention paid to it.
Yeah, well, this ceremony was held on Friday, on Memorial Day weekend there, and was also brought attention to the state of the cemetery, which has about 50 years' worth of weeds and downed trees that the town wants to clean up. And they're, the cemetery is getting the Dennis Historical Society is getting $60,000 in town community preservation money to clear up this mess and fix the gate. And in July, they'll start to clean and restore plot markers. Now, this isn't just to benefit the House family, which is estimated to have 3,000 descendants, but it's in anticipation of people's renewed interest in their colonial roots as the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower Voyage approaches in 2020.
And they're anticipating that folks are going to be coming, kind of looking for, perhaps trying to track down their genealogy and coming to the cemetery.
Yeah, Robert Poskett, he's co-manager of the Dennis Historical Society's cleanup of this plot, said that many families will be looking to do their genealogy, and it's going to be here in these headstones, which are interesting-looking headstones. There are curlicue carvings, engravings of skeleton heads, those old kind of macabre. We think of macabre, but I had great meeting to the people of those times. Mark Howes, he's a 54-year-old from Weymouth, attended the Friday ceremony, and he's descended from Jeremiah, the youngest son of Mary and Thomas Howes. And he says that the Howes family has regular reunions in Dennis, and he now is the one who's been the family that the task of keeping track of the family's genealogy has been handed on to him. He said, now I have the shoeboxes. So,
Cindy, before we wrap up here, I want to ask you to preview just briefly. You've been working on a series about Robert Kennedy. Tell us
approach. It'll be Sunday and Monday's paper about Robert F. Kennedy. I've written stories, and also Kathy Scrizzy Driscoll, who has interviewed members of the Kennedy family. And this is a look at his lost legacy, what he meant as this liberal progressive figure, and what was lost when he was assassinated, as well as his incredible love for the Cape. And his family, we think of President John F. Kennedy and Jackie's Camelot here on the Cape. But it was really Robert F. Kennedy and Ethel and their children who really had deep roots, kept returning to Cape over and over again.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Cindy.
You're welcome.
And I'll to my other contributors. We heard from Brittany Feldot, Falmouth Enterprise, Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. We spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Andy Tomolonis from SouthCoastToday.com. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.